You don't own me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'd never stay.
It's time for the Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com. This is Paul Daly here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And we're here to discuss the third episode of Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale.
This one's called Late.
We're going to approach this one in three chunks. We've got the flashback scenes. We've got Offred's narrative, and we've got Offglen's narrative.
So starting with our flashback scene, we get some answers right from the get-go about how did we get in this situation. I feel like that's been the common call out from every single person who is just sort of learning a little bit about this series. I was discussing with another woman just yesterday who was like, why are they wearing those clothes? And like, what time period is this set in? And when I try to say, oh, it's now, they're like, so they're trying to make like some sort of ancient time, like now, and that's why they're, and I'm like, no, it's so hard to explain. So I was really thankful for this flashback scene to explain how these moments happen. And there were some really great quotes that happened throughout the episode that I felt like really gave you that feeling of like, oh, I see how, you know, small steps become big steps. And then you look back and you can't even see where you started.
Even June rationalized, well, we were under martial law because of the attack on DC, and she could see herself agreeing, well, you know, that's a reasonable step. And then that is the stair step that brought them to women can't have property, you know?
Right. So in this flashback, it starts off with this pretty benign scene of her and Moira jogging, and the music is kind of slow, and they do these slow-mo scenes where, you know, they're kind of sweaty and they're kind of looking at their cleavage and that type of thing with the camera. And you see some, you know, admonishing looks from more conservative dressed women. When they stop jogging and they're just walking normally, they're wearing extremely normal outfits that you would see anyone wearing. And in fact, they're wearing even more modest outfits than you would think. They were wearing like several layers of t-shirts with a jacket, and Moira is wearing like leggings with even a skirt over the top. Like, it was a lot of modesty for the most part. They could have been wearing minute, you know, jogging shorts and barely even a top. We see that more here in Texas when women are jogging around. Even men, for God's sake, they're wearing those wind shorts that don't leave a lot to the imagination. So right from the get-go, we get the idea that there is this really high level of modesty and judgment going on. When they go into that coffee shop, and that shop clerk is such a dick, man. What were you reading as that whole scene, and how would that fly, at least here in the South?
Clearly, he's up on current events.
The attitudes of the day.
And this is a funny, like, how did they do that? Kind of reflection on what some people are concerned about with the current presidential administration. The idea that, well, he has said and been recorded saying certain things and bigoted things and all that kind of stuff. And that empowers other people to do the same where they might not have done so before. That seems like this guy, right? Where yesterday he might have been working at a ladies' shoe store, and now he's had it with women. And he works at the coffee shop, and he calls them names and tells them to get out and won't even try to run their card again. That same guy in the book did run the card again, but same effect. It didn't work because of the new law.
So the new law is that the banks have frozen all accounts that are female, and there's a new law that says that they can no longer own property. This is insane to me, and it's so crazy because I just had this conversation with my kids about the idea that, you know, all of our banking is done on computer, and it really is a touch of a button, and, you know, numbers are simply changed or moved around in a way that there's no actual like money bags sitting somewhere that are being moved around. So that part was kind of freaky to me. It really like lends me to the scariness of like Fox News and like we should exchange all our money for gold, and like I should be paying everybody in like little gold bars. I really felt like, oh man, I kind of understand that at this moment, and I kind of want to go get all our money out of the bank. Did you feel like just seeing episodes like this make you sort of want to act on today's world. Like, I kind of feel uncomfortable.
Well, I remember
sort of want to go get my money.
2008, when the bottom dropped out of the world and people's retirements were destroyed. Shitty practices of the mortgage.
Oh, sure.
That had made money just kind of disappear overnight. So people that had, you know, $500,000 in the bank, now the next day had like $400,000 in the bank. And like, because, you know, that's
absolutely,
that's pretty major.
Yeah.
The exact
it's
same
just
thing.
Freaky that it just, it's all numbers in a computer.
Right.
So scary. So, but does that make you want to go like grab our money out? Or does it make you have any kind of feeling of like, dang, that is like, I could really become a survivalist real quick.
I could see the logic in it. I mean, I've always seen some of the logic of some of that stuff.
Is it because you're a sci-fi guy and you've kind of seen the end of the world played out in about a million trillion different ways?
Oh, I know we're toast. If it comes down to it, we've got our little band we'd have to take care of here, and I don't think we'd get too far.
Oh my God, that's awful, P. Okay, so this insufficient funds thing is one component, but the other component is that at her work, June and all the women are let go, and Roger, her boss, is clearly freaked the hell out. Now, one thing I'd like to say is in Mad Men, one of the main bosses is Roger, and that would have been Peggy's boss as well. And so that's like funny for her to hear Peggy's voice as June saying, Roger, Roger, because, you know, that happened in previous seasons.
I have two comments on this scene. One is this is exactly how it was in the book, and a lot of the dialogue is lifted directly from the book. So this is like unadulterated Atwood here. The second thing was when she says, I think it's another kind of army.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of feeds my imagination, because when I look at those guys, yes, they're scary big guys with guns, but no, they're just wearing black outfits that they had in their closets. They're right. Not wearing uniforms.
You're right. They're just like all black.
So this tells me something about this regime change and how it seems more like a coup d'etat kind of thing, but where the people performing the coup d'etat hired their own army to do it. You know, like I was thinking maybe like-minded veterans or something, some group.
It was like large a call to action, basically.
That would have the training with the weapons, be able to step right into that role. Like, they didn't have to train up for this. You know what I mean? They were already pissed off about something or other. You know, they're not all like deserters or something. They're, you know, served at one point, and this is my guess. I'm not going off of anything other than my guess. It's just mm-hmm. their familiarity with machine guns and stuff like that would seem to lend themselves to having been exposed to that earlier in their life.
Could you see that, you know, I know I don't feel we know any men that would be caught up in this type of, I don't know, mass hysteria, but I suppose if we were under, you know, in that post 9/11 thinking where, you know, we were all ready to go to the blood banks and ready to give blood and do everything for anyone who had been in 9/11. Do you think that if we had been living in that type of world where they had told us there was other terrorist attacks and other things had happened, and they called to all the men and said, we need you to all come down to the local fire department and learn how to use a gun, because this is the way that we're going to have to defend ourselves. Everyone's going to have to become these sort of like colonist soldiers where, you know, you're going to have to defend your own homestead. You cannot rely on the army. Do you feel like that passion for protecting America versus these terrorists, do you think that you would feel like, you know, that would be natural? Like, I do think men in our neighborhood, including yourself, might show up and go get at least the basic training.
If it's posed to us like that,
mm-hmm.
then yes. But I mean, that's a really, you're so perfect at asking these impossible questions that make the person, you know, it's like Cards Against Humanity answering these questions.
Well, partially what I'm trying to get at is that, is there things that are even just television, it wouldn't necessarily have to be the government saying this to us, but if just like our town as a group had said, everyone please show up at, you know, Kingwood Baptist Church and we're all going to run some calisthenic drills. Women, we're just going to arbitrarily choose for you guys to stay home with the kiddos right now. And we're going to ask that all the men come on out. But that's just like neither here nor there. We're not asking just the men really. But in this case, for this Friday, it's just going to be the men. So come on down, men. And like, let's just make sure that everybody has all the training they need just in case our backs get against the wall and like the National Guard can't come out.
I think
wouldn't we go
for the Daily family here? If we were under some kind of threat that was going to require untrained people to take up arms, I think we'd bolt rather than stick around.
I do think that we would be pretty scared. And I do think that we would start looking at like how to get out of here. Thankfully, we do have pals in Canada and other places who I'm sure would take us in. But I feel like very much like, you know, I can remember post 9/11 and I can remember the weeks afterwards and, you know, the waving of the American flags and that it wouldn't take anything. I know you mentioned the current presidency, but I don't feel like that's anything. For me, I feel like it's the nationalism that comes. If you have this outside unknown enemy, you know, the terrorists that just like unnamed
Al Qaeda,
unnamed, no face enemy, right? There's just somebody lurking and we have to know how to defend ourselves. I feel really confident actually that our first gut thing may not be to run away to Canada, because no doubt they're saying, look, you guys, this is happening in every country. You're not safe anywhere. If you don't take a stand, if we don't dig our heels in, they're just going to take over the world. So here's our choices. Defend your family or die or become, you know, their slaves. So that's what we're fighting for, guys. You know, come or don't come, but that's the situation. So I feel like it would make sense to me that they made it very voluntary. And I like Moira's comment when she's like, you know, there probably wasn't ever even terrorists, because that is very likely, you know, that's how you kind of get people going. You know,
yeah.
That's why you can't even joke in the security line at the airport. You can't be like, I got a bomb in my bag. Ha ha. You know, you can't even say that, because just talk of it is enough to get people going. This was a very logical, foreseeable, and not at all. I don't think it has to do with any presidency. I don't think it has to do with any political climate. I think it has to do with our fears and what anybody is willing to do in the name of safety.
Up to the point where you turn machine guns on poster wielding women.
I agree with you. And they did show there was a lot of men in the crowd too, though. I mean, and actually a lot of the people who were getting shot were actually men that we actually saw get shot. The parts when things would get, of course, insane is, of course, when the women lost their jobs and they all were being paraded out. That is like where our mental break would be like, okay, let's pack the car. We need to leave. But by that point, you already have this other army that has already been trained and is already going around forcing the Rogers to act on these laws, and laws have already been passed. So it's like too late. When I talk about calling you guys out to do the training, I'm talking about 6 months before the jobs were lost, you know?
Yeah. But
this all happened where they were preparing you guys and they were feeding you guys some amount of information at that point so that you would be willing to turn on your neighbors, and then you have to be willing to turn on the Rogers, you know, for a really good reason. You have a really good reason, whatever really good reason they told you.
Luke didn't get the memo.
No, he didn't go to training day. He didn't go. He had other things to do. Good for him, but he didn't go. What did you think about the music that they chose to use with the Heart of Glass and Blondie at that really slow-mo motion? I've heard a lot of people complain about the slow-mo and that they maybe overused it in this episode. What's your thoughts on the visual and auditory?
I wasn't thrown by the stylistic choice of using slow-mo, and I liked the contrast of picking a song called Heart of Glass, or the original version was performed by Blondie, which was this kind of late 70s hyper-sexualized band built around this woman with platinum blonde hair and ruby red lips, and just kind of really played up the sexual angle of the songs that they made. So kind of the anti-woman to what Gilead is trying to promote. So they play that song sort of like while the machine guns are mowing down these people protesting, saying, no, we want our way of life back. And it's just like a really like kind of heart-wrenching contrast.
It was really shocking, right?
Yeah.
I was shocked when the machine gun started actually shooting. Like, it's one thing for the riot gear guys to start pushing the crowd back. That happens in almost every protest at some point.
Once they brought out those machine guns, when they decided to start going away from that, that was smart thinking, because there's no sane pacifying the resistance kind of commander would bring out machine guns unless he intended to use them.
And you could see the crowd, like that they zoomed in on several people's faces, and the sort of chill that you could see come across the crowd, like, wait a minute. You know, it's one thing to have the riot gear guys be up front. And I mean, to be fair, the protesters had, like, you know, thrown coffee and stuff in some of the riot gear guys' face. And, you know, they were getting more aggressive. And, you know, so maybe showing the guns was a way to say, like, hey, don't push us.
The next step's like tear gas and nightsticks.
You're right. 100%. 100%. And I mean, isn't that part of the lines from the Heart of Glass song? Don't they say something like, life's a gas or something like that? And so I honestly thought that there was like some part that they were just going to throw, yeah, you know, gas into the crowd. That's pretty standard stuff. But like, this was like, no way. This is to the extreme. I was thankful that Moira and June thought to run well before that. And when they run into that other little shop and they're hiding, I thought it was really telling that there was a point where they thought it was safe to come out, and they started to stand up and go. And that's when like the big glass explosion happened.
Yeah.
Indicative of the entire episode. There was like times when you thought, well, maybe it's safe enough. And then it got like worse before it's ever going to get better.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is her future now. Things are going to get worse before they get better.
You know, you mentioned Luke, and you mentioned the part where he didn't go with this training day kind of group in theory. And yet Moira was very much pointing a finger at him and saying, you know, you're the problem. It's you. It's the men that are really causing the problem, because these ideas are still pervasive. And I think that what she was saying was really true. The idea that, you know, us women are so delicate, we need to be protected by men. The gross, sick reality of it is, you know, exactly how it played out. You know, when Moira did need to walk to an extra, you know, layer of the train station, she kind of realized, like, you know what, I would actually be safer if a man was walking with me. And it was like a, because she didn't want that to be true, but it was true. And so it is that strange, I want to have this independent woman idea, but the reality is that, you know, our world, mainly because of men, is very unsafe for the majority of women a lot of the time. And like it or not, we are safer a lot of times when at least we either can walk in groups, or, you know, we walk with a man is always helpful. But I mean, I was taught always, and I teach our own kids, like, never go anywhere alone. You be like safety in numbers. There's a reason why that's a saying, right?
Yeah. She doesn't want to accept his offer, but she sees the logic in it and goes along like, damn it.
Exactly. And I kind of feel like that is, again, sort of indicative of our real world situation. Like, how bad, you know, women in general want to be more independent. And it's so distressing that of men in the world, and maybe even a small number, honestly, make us have that enough of a level of feeling unsafe. And even beyond feeling, people are attacked, or there are enough people that are crazy, as Moira puts it. And it's like, God, it's just such a crazy world. Like, I can't afford to make the wrong decision here and be alone. I just can't. And it sucks, but I can't. I appreciate that feeling, because I feel the same way. There's, you know, today we were in a parking lot, and the kids were like, well, we can just stay in the car when you run in. And I'm like, you know what? No, actually you can't. I'm not comfortable with that. This is an area that I'm not as comfortable. And it just is what it is. You know, it sucks to have to feel that way, but that's our world, you know?
Yeah.
So speaking of our world, we get back to Offred, and we get back to her story, where she's at and what's going on with her. It's a pretty simple story this week for her, but, you know, very layered in emotion and brutality.
We all start with a misunderstanding of Offred's condition.
Well, and it's maybe, I mean, that's the title, late. I mean, I do think she is legitimately late with her period. And so that is what leads, I guess, Martha takes care of the tampon and pad
distribution.
Apparently. I don't know why, since, you know, it's Offred that does the shopping. I'm not quite sure why there has to be someone else who takes care of like where those items are. But okay, so she's given this like hearty lunch, which we kind of talked about in a previous episode. Like, why wouldn't they give them hearty lunches and good things to eat and take care of their bodies prior to thinking they're pregnant? Why did they get beat around and apparently not good food and such before they're pregnant and then treated well when they are, it's kind of stupid. It's like you want to say, hey, have you all heard of prenatal vitamins and the idea of having a body that's healthy and ready to accept?
It might be that Rita, the Martha we're talking about, is following Serena's example. Because Serena sets the tone for the treatment of Offred in this period.
She very much does. And she actually has Offred go with her to go visit Angela, the new baby that's born over at the Putnam's house, Janine's offspring. And they visit Naomi, the wife. And it turns out that Janine is having quite a go over there. This would be a pretty extreme level of postpartum, I would say. And I guess also just the sign of the times, like that the situation is so twisted up and so crazy that maybe Janine is being very normal for the bizarre set of circumstances she's been placed in.
She's still sleeping with that panda, though.
Oh, I know that hurts your heart, Paul.
It does. It makes me feel bad for her because she just doesn't seem like she's going to get it. She understands one thing, that she, having given birth to one healthy baby at this point, does buy her some cachet as a handmaid.
Mostly ice cream, it sounds like, which she was happy to get. And I felt good that she was actually getting some better treatment. But I guess it turns out that she, you know, is really trying to cling to the baby, which is completely understandable. And it's pretty awful that they don't just have her pump. You know, again, this is modern times. There's really no reason that they couldn't use a pump of some sort and not actually have her bond with the baby through this breastfeeding. It seems like, I totally understand wanting to use breast milk, but I don't know why they wouldn't give Naomi the opportunity to bond with Angela feeding her with a bottle. It actually seems pretty counterintuitive to do it this way.
And it's weird because it's not like breast pumps are something like akin to the other medical technology that they're abandoning related to the birthing process. I mean, it has nothing to do with it. It's a completely just a mechanical device.
It didn't really feel like it would be anti-biblical, except for just that it's a more modern invention. But I understand that they're sort of going back to basics, if you will. But in this particular case, the way that they used the birthing chair and they had Naomi bond with the baby right after Janine gave birth, it seemed like they would have been a little bit more savvy about trying to get Naomi to bond with Angela through this feeding process. So, you know, I was pretty shocked, however, when Naomi has this busted up hand and she's like, oh yeah, you know, it bit me. I was like, do what? I mean, Janine, what is up?
Having that baby will only get you so far, I'm afraid.
Holy smokes.
If you're biting the wives, word will get around.
Well, here's the thing though. Apparently Janine's got this way more complex plan in place, and apparently she's been playing some sort of games with Warren Putnam and is got this delusion that he is going to take her away and she's renamed the baby Charlotte and that they're going to go off and have some life together. What?
Classic other woman fantasy, right?
I guess so. But like, tell me, like, is this something that the book was keen on? Did other handmaidens have this fantasy that somehow the commander would fall in love with them and they would go off and have this life?
In the book, Janine does give birth and we keep up with Janine a little bit, but we don't really get into Janine as a point of view character and get into her head. Offred in the book doesn't really like Janine.
Well, I don't know that she loves Janine as is, but I do think that she sees, you know, a fellow handmaiden losing her mind. And, you know, she even expresses that to Serena Joy, which I was pretty shocked at. Did you think it was pretty surprising that she was that honest with Serena Joy?
Well, yes, because Offred's been through so much, you'd think she'd be smarter than to let her guard down after like 5 seconds of humane treatment. You know?
Well, and I also kind of felt like it a little bit was throwing Janine under the bus. Like, what if Serena Joy turned around and was like, Naomi, you need to cut that shit off. Go ahead and slap her around. She's apparently losing it. Like Offred said, you know, like it seemed a little like, ooh, I don't know why you would expose that about Janine to your wife here. I don't know. It just seemed very counterproductive to their whole supportive handmaiden union. So were you surprised when Serena Joy sent her home alone with Nick in the car? I thought that being alone with a man like that would be like completely against the rules. Didn't seem like, you know, I don't know. They have these toads, like Nick could just jump on her at any time. Everybody's wild animals. If you're not paying attention, the slut handmaiden's going to jump on Nick and Nick's going to jump on her and everything crazy is going to happen. That's why they got to go in twos all the time everywhere.
Great point. I mean, yeah, specter of a looming death penalty for any crime, it seems, is always there. But they still have these safeguards of handmaids traveling in pairs and all that.
Do you think Serena Joy was setting her up there with Nick to go back to the house by herself? Did she know that the eye people were going to be there to question about off Glenn? Did she know Aunt Lydia was going to be there and she like didn't want to be a part of it? Or what's up?
I'm almost positive she did know that she was sending her to an interrogation. You know, she was like, you go home now. P.S. because you have an appointment.
I felt awful that Nick was trying to tell her, you know, in the car, like, you know, his wording. Oh, my God. It was really heart wrenching when he was like, brave isn't a part of this. Everybody breaks everybody. I felt like we were like riding the escalator to doom at every sentence that Nick was saying. Did you know this was going to happen? Did you know the interrogation was going to be going on?
No, only when she asked him a question and he answered it without answering it and started going on with the they're going to torture you kind of talk, then it started to seem pretty fishy, like she was getting railroaded into something.
Yeah, this guy, this casting for the interrogator made my stomach barf. His voice was so freaking nasal. I hated it, hated it, hated it. You know, she's trying to beg to God that she doesn't get hurt in her head. And everything he says just feels so gross and condescending. I wanted to barf. How did you feel about this whole Aunt Lydia and interrogator twosome? Did this questioning even feel like this was real, or was it like she was just going to be beat up no matter what she said?
They're trying to get to the bottom of whether or not Offred knew that Off Glenn was a lesbian and if she and Off Glenn did any female on female fooling around. Right. That's basically what they're trying to find out.
Well, and even I felt like they were presenting it like Off Glenn might have like molested her. How they were like, did she touch you? Like, I felt like they were speaking to her more like a child, like show me on this doll where she touched you. Like, I didn't feel like they were trying to act like it was like a consensual situation, but they were sort of saying it more like you were alone down there. Did she try to do anything to you?
Yeah. That. Okay. Like that very old idea of the dangers homosexuals present in your neighborhood. Not only are they deviants that lie with this with their same sex, but they're also a danger to you. They're coming for you, Barbara.
Exactly. That they're very predatory, you know, right? Like as if someone who is gay is synonymous with being a pedophile or something.
Right, right.
And it's, I mean, we all know that that is not true. And of course they are probably way less likely to try to do something like that.
I believe that's very true.
Yeah. And so that all that stuff seems like crazy to us when we watch this, but the way that the questioning was, you really got that idea is that was their belief system. To me, there were several ways that she answered some of these questions that I don't know if I just felt like she's just not at that point of being ready to protect herself in the way that she answers things, or if she's still at this point where she feels like it's right to sort of snip back, you know, anytime she has that opportunity. But there were things like, you know, when she is asked if she knew that she was gay, but they use the word gender traitor. To me, I felt like when she said, yes, she mentioned her wife before, I feel like, and I know she was scared out of her mind, so I understand if she couldn't think clearly. I cannot imagine getting cattle prodded at the beginning of the conversation.
To set the tone.
I can't even imagine it. I mean, honest to God, I can't imagine. But I feel like my mind would have been in overdrive to try to come up with some sort of explanation, whether it was real or completely fictitious in that moment. So I feel like I would have said something like, yeah, she told me she had a wife before, But I guess I assumed after the Red Center training that she had been turned or something. I don't know, some sort of something where I was like, I felt the Red Center would have cured her. And so I never thought that any handmaiden who had made it through the training would act on any gender training kind of thing, because I thought that that would have been cured out of her, or some asinine comment like that. I feel like I would have said something that would have said,
well, you would have gotten a lot less cattle prodding.
I kind of think I would have been tap dancing for my freaking life not to be cattle prodded. But, and I'm not, you know, again, she was terrified. I'm not trying to make light of the situation, but I do think I would have been doing a lot of like rationale out loud explanation of like, well, everyone had a life before, and I don't try to get bogged down in those things because I feel like, you know, their lives before, they repented for that. And so I am assuming that everyone is here because we're here on the right, for the right reasons, you know, to procreate. And I'd be like, yay, you know, like something like that. I mean, did you think it was odd that she didn't try to make any explanation and even poked back at Aunt Lydia with the gay talk, knowing that was going to end in a bad way?
Well, what got Lydia was the, some no theologian. I don't quote the Bible.
Father Paul.
Don't do any of that. But I have to assume that when Lydia said, remember your scripture, and the line about
meek,
being meek, I got to assume that in the Gilead version of the Bible, maybe that's where the scripture freaking ends, you know?
I think so too, yeah.
And when she said the rest of the line, and she said, I remember, that's the part. I mean, obviously that's when Lydia hits her, but I mean, that's the part where she also should have known better. Like, she should have seen that.
So coming. Do you feel that way? Or do you feel like the selective insubordination is totally realistic and you would have pulled that business too? Or do you think that, like, would you have heeded Nick's warning and been like, Brave, it does not have a place in this world. Like, you need to protect yourself. It's not a thing. So don't try to think that you could go in there and put on your like, oh yeah, kind of attitude.
Because they've
like,
already kicked your ass. You're wearing the red dress.
Right.
You know, you are in this now. So yeah, it would have been team me, you know, and I'm sorry, but I it'd be nice to say that I would try to rub shit in Lydia's eye right then. But she had this guy, an eye with her.
She had machine guns outside.
She had the cattle prod.
Yeah.
She'd already given me like a warning shot and another one.
Yeah. I couldn't do it. I think two shocks and I would have.
Plus, there's history with her. You know how far she'll go for
this stuff. Dude, you just visited with One-Eyed Janine earlier today. How could you possibly justify saying anything? I couldn't. Especially after she had had that silent, please don't let me get hurt prayer that she had said prior to this interrogation. I just don't get why she would have had that same gusto for Bible verses in that moment. I just couldn't have. So continuing on with her story, you know, Serena Joy comes bursting in when Lydia really smashes her really hard against the face with that cattle prod and is like buzzing her in the head and is like, she's pregnant. That moment when that freaking investigator is like, oh, this is wonderful news. Oh, his voice. I was dying, right? And he was like, what blessed news. Oh, wow. Oh, I wanted to like kick him in the balls, Paul.
Do you remember when we were having to visit the hospital quite a bit? It wasn't a man-woman thing. It was a doctor-nurse thing. The idea that doctors deal in doctor business, nurses deal in nurses business. They work in the same building, but they really don't have much to do with each other.
Okay.
And doctors would never do a nurse's duty, just as preposterous as it would be for a nurse to attempt a doctor's duty.
Okay.
That seems to be the relationship between men and aunts, at least. Like, I'm here to answer... I'm here to ask questions, get your answers, and you are just going to handle the woman side of this. So if that, you know, it involves getting this woman to be compliant with me, I'm going to let you handle that your woman way. And I'm just going to operate doing my man stuff. So that allowed him to be very detached from this whole thing, which is how you could possibly see this human writhing around on the ground say, congratulations.
Oh, that this is a blessed thing. And I mean, right. Oh my God. I felt like Serena Joy was the only sane one in the room who was like, get out of my house. Like, oh my God. Honestly, it was the first time I saw Serena Joy as an actual human.
Well, and I mean, if you think about all of the fear that would then probably wash over eventually that guy, even though he seemed pretty thick. But Lydia, the idea of their actions maybe mm-hmm. killing a commander's offspring,
mm-hmm.
there's got to be repercussions for that.
Lydia's
in this world.
Face was, she did bring her hand up to her mouth and was like, oh my God, what have I done? Kind of face. I just wish that would stick with her. Like, I feel like it washed right off of her in 2 seconds. But I do really feel like that moment should have stuck. And again, in that whole like trying to protect myself, as the story goes on and Serena Joy has now started to transform this bedroom into a nursery and Offred is back in her, you know, her bedroom with this bruised face and Nick comes and gives her ice. I thought that was a very steamy moment between her and Nick. I don't know where that's all headed, but I think we could see some pretty serious intimacy between the two of them. When he hands her the ice, he gets like all up in her. Like, I feel like you could feel the heat off each other's skin in that moment. That was some hot business. When he says, I feel like I should have just driven away with you. What? That's a handmaiden's goddamn dream, right? I mean, that's all anyone wants to hear. That's the white knight in shining armor. I should have taken you away from all of this, right?
Right.
That's what Cinderella wanted to hear. That's what every horrible slave situation wants to hear. I could get you away from all of this. That's Dolores on Westworld, right? We're finally going to get away from all of this, right?
Right. She doesn't use the ice. She just lets it fall on the floor.
Right. Why do you think that is?
I'm going to go with my friend Inez's theory.
Oh, hit it.
She can't accept things from these people. Like last week, she couldn't accept the cookie. This week, she can't accept the ice because it falls under this phony kindness that she just, the same aspect of her that made her mouth off to Lydia is the same that can't accept things from the establishment. As being true acts of kindness, that there's ulterior motive to all of it, and she'd rather not be a part of it.
I like that theory, but I'm going to take it a little bit differently in this particular case. So I think that if you put ice on a wound, it heals faster. And I think it's to her advantage to have a bigger, badder bruise on her face longer than it is for her to heal up and it be gone tomorrow. I think that it's advantageous to her to have a bruise that lasts a week on her face. I think she wants the commander to see it. I think she wants everyone to see it. And not in an ugly, nasty, gross kind of way, but like from a point of like, I'm not going to cover up what you're doing to me. And I'm not going to make it heal up nicer. And I'm not going to make my face look better. You are going to have to look at what you are putting me through. And I'm not going to make it look better.
That also plays into how you would have played this next scene completely differently than Offred did.
Dude, I just would have. So when she goes down and she's going to tell Serena Joy that she has gotten her period and she's not pregnant. Okay, y'all, I admit I would have played this a billion times differently. And to be truthful, she doesn't know it didn't turn out this way. So she was late, okay? And she did have this awful cattle prod situation with Aunt Lydia. She was hit. And even some people would say the emotional stress of being put through an interrogation would actually have been enough. When she has to tell Serena Joy that she's not pregnant, I would have prefaced all of that. And especially the part when Serena Joy says, when did you get your period? I would have said after the beating. I would never have said last night. I would have said after I cried because of the interrogation, after my face was bruised, after I felt the electric shocks going through my body, that killed the fetus. I would have 150% blamed that entire situation. There's no way that I would have just let it go at just like last night and not have brought up like this. I kind of would have shown my face to her a little, like turned my head, like basically when all this happened here, not here so much, but here where this giant bruise is and like where they cattle prodded my neck, that's when I had the miscarriage. That's when it all happened. And I would have pointed all fingers at Aunt Lydia and the interrogation. And I would have been like, I wish that I could have protected the baby more, but you saw me on the floor. They smashed the baby into the ground. And that's how this all went down. Would you have played it differently?
I haven't even thought of that. That is the only way you could have played it and come out on top. Offred isn't with it enough. She's either intimidated by Serena Joy or not quick thinking enough to come up with it, because she kind of just clams up.
She had so much time. When they showed her sitting on that chair
the previous night,
holding her underwear,
right?
I felt like that's what she was doing. I felt like she was trying to come up with like exactly what she was going to say.
Maybe she was thrown by the nursery being put together so quickly.
Well, did you see that look that she had on her face when Serena Joy was explaining that she was the miracle? It was some really messed up version of sort of being upset, but also this jokery smile that was having. I can't explain it, but she was showing a lot of teeth. It was very odd. And so it was like a little bit like she was getting some messed up pleasure out of telling her she wasn't pregnant. Like, I don't know, you know, everyone is exercising their power in their own messed up ways. And so here she has been controlled by Serena Joy each and every aspect of her life. Well, the one thing that she holds any cards on is whether she's pregnant or not. And she's the only one that gets to tell that news, right?
Yeah.
So she has this powerful moment. Maybe I would have gotten called out on it. Serena Joy might have turned on me and said, how dare you make excuses for your shitty body or something. I could have gotten double whipped for my excuse of the situation. But there's just no way I would have gone down without a fight. That's all I'm saying. I would not have been thrown in that room without some reminder that I had been abused, and that is why, even just emotionally, that it had been such a strain to have this off Glenn situation happen to me. You know, here I was almost molested by this, you know, person, you know, like, I mean, I would have played it and played out. I've been like, I walked with a gender traitor. That's enough stress for me, you know, kind of played up on that, my delicate nature of this whole thing. That's where I would have gone, for good or for bad. You know, that's how I would have played it. So Serena Joy throwing me to the floor and screaming, do you understand, in my face? Just letting you know, at least this handmaiden over here would not have let that fly. I'd have been like, I understand a lot of things. I understand how babies get in bellies, and this is not a healthy way for this to go down. Do you understand? Oh, no, you don't have any babies. Sorry, Serena Joy, you might not know.
Wow. Yeah.
Just saying, I'd have been a fucking snake in a sitch, okay? Don't push me around, yo.
No, I know better.
You do know better. So speaking of a really, really, really unbelievably horrible situation, and I know that this part of the episode had a lot of people, especially the ending, turn off the TV and back off and say, damn, I don't know if this series is for me or not. So let's talk about Off Glenn and talk about what happened with her.
First time we see her, Offred is giving us narration, telling us basically that she believes, due to, you know, some rumors, that Off Glenn has been taken due to her supposed role within a resistance.
There is zero conversation about that it could have anything to do with her sexuality, but that she is absolutely certain this has to do with the us them situation.
That's not the case. Apparently they don't give a shit about the resistance aspect of Off Glenn. And they're not interested in having her say anything at all. She's wearing this sling around her jaw that prevents her from talking.
I feel like this is a good time to mention that Atwood made a really clear statement that nothing that was in the book, and this was in the book, I guess, on some level, has been made up. the idea of like having that sling kind of thing around your face or what happens to Off Glenn. None of these things are anything that hasn't happened in history already. This is not a made up or in any way imagined concept. This is all real, and that should make it all that much more terrifying to all of us.
So they string Off Glenn's story along for the whole show, and it gets to a high point in a trial where both she and a Martha, who we now understand is her clandestine girlfriend.
Well, and I'd like to put a caveat here and say accused girlfriend. Right. We don't actually know anything.
Right.
These two women may have done absolutely nothing with one another that would have been inappropriate, except for perhaps be friends. Maybe they were kind to one another in the company of someone else. Maybe they were caught laughing, whispering. Maybe the Martha gave her extra food. Anything could have been supposed to create the story. Neither of these women get an opportunity to defend the charges against them. They don't even have the sling taken off their faces. The prosecutor has to be the one to say that he swears it's the truth. There's no defender. There's no nothing. Kangaroo court to the hilt.
I don't know if you ever watched THX 1138 with me, but it reminded me a lot of this legal proceeding in that, where the accused don't ever get to talk and their legal representation and the whole process happens so fast that they all just talk over one another and the decision is rendered super quickly with, like I said, no input from the accused at all.
You know, I feel like also when I think about the idea of the justice system, it invokes that concept of Lady Justice, actually a woman with a blindfold on her eyes, meaning like it doesn't matter who you are, everyone gets a fair trial. So the idea of, if you can imagine, the slipping of the blindfold down to the mouth, and that is like the sling on their faces. Like, it's such imagery to me that we're also used to there being the blindfold, and now it's like covering your mouth.
Interesting take. So they sentence the Martha.
It's mumbo jumbo kind of stuff. Like, basically, you know, she's at the mercy of the common something, which just means you're going to die. There's nothing.
Off Glenn is to be redeemed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Redemption.
So they stage this super terrifyingly effectively. They put them both in the back of the same paddy wagon.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that people are hanged. I prefer to use hanged instead of hung. Both are correct.
Oh, okay.
People are hanged left and right everywhere from anything high enough to hang a person from. It seems that's how Gilead works.
And they're left to decompose there.
But in this case, this wasn't one of those out in public for everyone to see kind of hanging locations. This was just, they had a crane set up. And they just walked her out, hooked her up to the crane, lifted her up, and suffocated her. Now, according to execution standards, you're supposed to break the person's neck. That's the whole idea of the gallows, is to break their neck so they don't just suffer for 2 or 3 minutes as they die.
Dang, I don't know anything about execution. So explain to us, what is the difference between the way that, like, traditionally people have been hung and the way that this was done?
The gallows has the table that drops out from underneath the person. And the jerk from that drop is supposed to break their neck so that they die relatively quickly.
Okay.
Whereas in those other kinds of hangings where there's no neck breaking and they just suffocate, think of how long you can hold your breath.
So that's like because of the way that they raised her up rather than dropping her down.
Yeah, they just gently lifted her up. So eventually,
it's like the weight of her own body was pressing on her own throat.
Right. Exactly, yes.
So it's almost like, it sounds weird, but almost more like a suicide, like her own body's killing her own self.
Assisted, yes.
Of course, but I mean, symbolically, she killed herself in that situation rather than they broke her neck. Her own body crushed her own throat.
Sounds like you work for the Gilead Department of Corrections.
I'm just saying, I think that there's some symbolism there in terms of the way that they handled it.
Well, and it's super terrifying because it was handled so casually.
Right.
They started to drive off before she even died. Like, you know, we got to keep a schedule here, people.
Yeah. Well, but the idea that we had seen so many other people hung and they were over like a bridge or something where they would have been pushed or they would have been handled in a different way, it makes me feel like it was purposely handled in a different way.
Yeah.
So Then we have Off Glen, and you know, this is very difficult to talk about, and we kind of chose not to have a third guest host with us at all because I felt like this was very delicate and we wanted to go very slow with how we talked about this. A lot of people on our Facebook page that we're admins with, which is
The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu, Gilead Online,
has asked so many questions about like what happened at the end, what was that, what surgery or what did they do. And I saw a bunch of different things, you know, did they sew her up, what did they do to her? Okay, so the initials to what they did would be FGM, which you can look up. The correct term would be female genital mutilation. There's layman's terms, and if you just want to look it up, you can do that. The main thing is that they took away any outward pleasure that Off Glen could have had in having sex, and that they still allowed her body to be intact to be able to continue to giving birth. I feel like that the part about taking away her own sexuality in this way and her own ability to have an orgasm basically is how a lot of people would look at it. It's so much more than that. It's so much more of this personal, I can't really even describe it, like robbing her of her own identity in a lot of strange ways. It's just such this personal thing,
well,
you know?
And I mean, there's also the element that yes, doing that will deprive her of certain physical pleasures. But Lydia says that they, by doing this, removed her desire.
Which is insane.
Yeah, which is insane.
Apparently that is the predominant thinking, though, is that somehow having any external at all stimulus is what would make a woman want to have any type of intercourse. And so therefore, if you take that away, that is like current thinking still, I guess. It's all very crazy. Anyone who could watch any of that and not have their stomach just tie in a knot, go see a shrink now, because this is really, really crazy stuff and really awful. Now, we want to talk about a couple of things about this. First of all, if you guys didn't realize, Off Glen, or the actress Alexis Bledel, actually said zero words in this episode. And that's super interesting to me, that every single bit of this entire episode that we saw her in was acted on her part just from her eyes and her forehead, basically. That's it. Because, you know, her whole lower half of her face was covered and she never had even like a narration over, you know, what
or
she was
grunt
thinking.
Or a peep or
nothing, nothing. So when you guys think about how much emotion you had for her, how much sympathy, empathy, everything that you had for the situation, imagine the fact that you did that essentially with someone miming like what was going on with her, with very little like body movements or anything. It was like all in her eyes. So when we talk about Alexis Bledel having grown as an actress, I feel like we can say that was amazing. I mean,
well, yeah. I mean, on Gilmore Girls, she said a million words and never made you feel like she did in this episode.
Yeah, we didn't have the same connection at all. So I definitely felt like this ending, this entire scene was heart-wrenching. I felt like Ann Dowd did an amazing job of being absolutely terrifying, as always. I felt like we all were really driven to understand more about what FGM is and what is going on. I did want to share with you guys a little bit of just like current statistics so that you guys could really understand that this is not something that Atwood made up as some sadistic thing. This is something that happens. So currently 200 million girls and women are alive that have undergone FGM, 200 million. And it's an estimated that 3 million women are at risk this year. And many people that this happens to, women, are 10 years old or younger. And some of the stuff that I read about this is just insane to me. In Somalia, 98% of the female population have had this happen. And they consider this like initiation. And it's really messed up. A lot of this happens to girls who are under 5 years old, where they're actually stolen away from their family. This is not done with the family's permission. They're actually like dragged out to the woods, to the jungle, and this happens to them, not with medical care, not with any type of sedative or anesthesia, and that this is done in conditions where many bleed out and just die because this is just done with a razor blade. Like, this is psychotic. I know, it's true. Here's the main thing also that you really need to know when you think like, this doesn't happen around here, that's just in Africa. And I've kind of heard that comment. 137,000 women in the UK have had this happen. And that's just current statistics. And that's people who admit to it. That's people who readily make this number known. And you guys can imagine that this is a situation where people are very private about it and have their own shame about it. So it's not even something that is talked about. And I feel like the fact that there were so many of us, women and men together, who didn't even understand what had happened in that scene. We all watched it. We may have even watched it a second time and said, I still don't understand what happened to her. And then had to come on, you know, the various chat rooms, and still people would explain and not have an idea of what was happening. And we had to get even more, as admins, be even more graphic for people of like, this is what happened. These are the body parts we're talking about. It got really uncomfortable for people, but I think it also started this really good conversation. And one of the things we wanted to do, I saw a man actually on our Facebook group asked, you know, where could he find out more about charities or organizations that are working on stopping this? And I thought that that was really a great way to turn this conversation from just something that scared us all and grossed us all out to like, if you don't like this and you don't like what's going on, then be a part of the solution. And so we're actually going to add a link to our website, dailyreview.com, that offers a variety of different organizations and charities that are doing things right now and that you can donate to or you can become active with, so that you feel like, you know what, if these stories are speaking to you, please make your voice be heard that this is not okay with you. So moving forward with our characters, I know that Aufglen was not really talked about in the book, especially she didn't have all this backstory or anything. So we all feel like Alexis Bledel is going to stick around. So do you think she's just going to be thrown back in the Handmaid's grouping here and we're just going to start seeing her again? How can they do that? And do you think they know anything about the us-them resistance part, or they really just grabbed her up because of the gay part?
Last question first. Yes, they grabbed her up because of the gay part.
Okay.
I think we will keep up with her, but if she remains in the same pool as Offred,
yeah,
that's only because this is a small production.
That's what it will, you know,
because that's the sort of person you would move in
reality.
Don't
you think that the community is small? Don't you think the commanders do live, like we kind of described, like in like a green zone where like they are doing a really hardcore job? Because think of the Birthmobile coming through and picking everyone up. I mean, isn't this handled in a very small, controlled way?
Sure, but there's going to be surviving population centers and other places of governance. So
you think that they ship them out further away? I just don't. I just think that they're all under lock and key. I think Aunt Lydia's got her hand on everybody. And I don't think she leaves this area. That's my feel. But okay. I don't know how the book went.
It was only from Offred's point of view. And she only knew what she knew. And she only stayed where she stayed. You know, so
I thought it was interesting in the story how they added the line at the beginning that they found out because of the Martha, because of Rita. That's how she found out. So that's like how they enabled Offred's POV to tell us the story, because otherwise, obviously, how could they ever have said anything?
It's interesting seeing the translation from book to show, because in the book, there are several times when she tells us something. And then at the end, she says, that's how I think it happened, or that's how I think it should have gone.
Mm-hmm.
So she's quasi-reliable as a narrator because she wants us to think these certain things about certain people, but she wasn't there.
I think that's fascinating and something that I really want our listeners to kind of mull around in their brains and give us some feedback on. Is Offred a reliable narrator? And can she possibly be? I mean, we know she sees it from only her point of view. She doesn't possibly know what the commanders or Serena Joy or the Marthas or Nick's life or anything is really all about, or what's going on in the colonies or what's going on beyond her. And, you know, whether this, I don't want to say is the way it has to be, but in some messed up way, was this the only choice? I feel like the concept of having a reliable narrator is huge when you're trying to empathize and trying to understand this situation. And I don't know.
I think there might have been a small change from the book. Because when you said, is this the only way? The impression I get from the show
mm-hmm.
is that one way or the other, they decided your ovaries and uterus work and you're not a wife, so you become a handmaid.
Okay.
Okay. Do you have the same impression, or do you have?
I think so. I think. I'm not sure how the wife commander business actually all works, but I believe that's it.
In the book, she refers to that she did have a choice at somewhere along the way, but I think the choice was handmaid or colonies. I think that was the choice.
Okay.
Because she makes it sound like it wasn't much of a choice.
Intrigue. So, I mean, I have read a couple different things that the showrunner has said that we are going to see more about the colonies, which I guess in the book we don't. Mm. And also we're going to find out more about the Red Center and see more about how that all works and just more from different other people's point of view. And I also saw that in the book, I guess, Serena and the commander's position in life was that they were being nostalgic about having had children and that they were wanting to sort of relive that portion of their life. And that's where this all came in, as opposed to this time when Serena and Fred are actually in the time of life when you would be raising children, and that they like purposely put them in this sort of more desperate situation where they had never had children before. And that was all on purpose to not just be in competition with Offred by her age, but also that sort of stage of life, that they would have been people who would have been very envious of the life that Luke and Hannah and June had been having, and that they hadn't had that yet. Hmm. And so that's a lot about this anger and resentment that you can see very built up in Serena. That would be very different if you had already raised children yourself and were just nostalgic for that time. I don't think there would be that same seething animosity towards like, you had it and I didn't, and I'm supposed to be the have and you're supposed to be the have not, so this isn't fair.
I could see that, and how using younger commanders and wives for a TV show ratchets up the drama in a way that in the book it's okay that they were older. And even in the movie, it was Robert Duvall and Faye Dunaway who were
an older couple,
with Natasha Richardson being the younger handmaid. And it did give the commander a very commanderly sort of gravitas,
right?
You know, I'm waiting to see how they change Serena Joy's backstory, because they do explain old Serena Joy's backstory in the book.
Interesting.
And yeah, they could shoehorn it into this one, but it really wouldn't make any sense.
I could see them coming up with a different story, her yeah. being younger and everything. One of the things that I think that just from you describing Robert Duvall's character and just kind of knowing him and what he looks like and the presence he would have, one of the things that I feel like is very different is about this idea that Joseph Fiennes is so much more, I think, kind of vulnerable because he's younger to me, and this sort of a little bit more of a sense of like neediness with him, I feel, than I think I would feel with Robert Duvall. Like, I feel like he would seem very stalwart and very, I don't know, maybe even a little stoic or whatever. But there's something about Joseph Fiennes and the way he's playing this so far that actually doesn't come off in this shut up and listen kind of way. And maybe it's because of these Scrabble scenes and everything that we've had.
Joseph Fiennes is coming off very sympathetic.
That's what I mean.
Like, whereas Robert Duvall came off condescending.
And that's one of the things that I know the showrunner said, that he was actually a little like, about the fact that actually Serena Joy and Fred were actually an attractive couple. That was actually a little problematic, because you are kind of sympathetic with them because they're not ugly to us. You know, there is a little bit of sympathy there. It just, I don't know. And again, the fact that they had never had children, see, they're just this young couple wanting a family. You know, you could kind of make up this messed up story. Mm-hmm. It's not okay. Nothing's okay about this. But I definitely feel like I can understand why the showrunner, you know, would say this is a little bit problematic. We're really enjoying the story. We really want to recommend that you guys are reading the reviews done by Aaron Conrad over at 3ifbyspace.net, and that you're keeping up with the Facebook page.
The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu, Gilead Online.
It is completely gaining traction.
We just hit 500 people tonight.
Which is kind of insane, because I would say within the last, what, week?
We hit like 300 2 days ago. So yeah, we're growing pretty good.
It's amazing. It's amazing, you guys. And so if you really want to get on this conversation, let me just tell you, you're missing out if you're not over on the Facebook page. And also, we're live tweeting at 9 p.m. Central Time on Twitter. We encourage you guys to get on over there on Wednesday nights to live tweet along with us. And even if you watched it early in their day, that's great. Then that means when you come on over and watch it with us and live tweet, you actually have some insight. Maybe some things have kind of churned around for you and you're ready to tweet and ask questions and point out specific scenes and maybe things that you're wondering about. So
search hashtag Handmaid's Tale.
We'll look forward to talking to you guys then.
Thanks. Catch us on iTunes or your preferred podcast software. Our website, dailyreview.com. That's D-A-L-E-Y review.com. Facebook or Twitter or wherever you find us. Please leave us a comment and a rating to let us know what you think of the show.
Thanks for listening, pot people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.